There are a lot of good ideas that people hate when you tell them about it.
That is Steve Landsberg.
I teach economics at the University of Rochester. I write books about economics.
Books that apply an economic treatment to topics that don't usually get the economic treatment. For instance, in his book, More Sex is Safer Sex, Landsberg argues that people who are free of sexually transmitted diseases, or STDs, should be having a lot more sex, since their participation in the sex pool would diminish the overall risk of disease.
The main theme of the book is that things work out badly when people do not feel the full consequences of their actions. And things work out better when people do feel the full consequences of their actions.
People who do have STDs, Landsberg argues, don't feel the full consequences of their actions.
And so people are not fully accounting for the damage that they're doing to other people when they make decisions. And likewise, when you get into a line.
When you get into a line? Like a line at a restaurant? At the bank? What kind of damage am I doing in a line?
When you get into a line, you're not fully accounting for the fact that you are slowing down everybody who arrives after you. Once again, you're taking an action that does not account for the costs you're imposing on other people.
Okay. It is not as exciting as talking about sex, but today on Freakonomics Radio, let's talk about lines.
It's hot. I could keel over right now.
How long ago did you get here?
About, say,
3 days ago.
40 minutes.
What are lines for, anyway, from an economic perspective?
We use queues as a way to deal with short-term fluctuations in demand.
Can anything good come from all that waiting?
Being patient is basically more important than having a high IQ for being successful in life.
And is there a better way to get what we want?
Instead of sending people to the back of the line, we send people to the front of the line.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
I am not the kind of person who enjoys standing in lines. Maybe you are. I'm not. I'll do just about anything I can to avoid a line. There's one movie theater near where I live that lets you buy specific seats online so that you don't have to show up 45 minutes early to get a seat. If I feel like going to the movies, I will generally go see whatever that theater is showing rather than fight the long lines at another theater. I will always pay extra, within reason, to buy back the time that a line would steal from me. There are, of course, different kinds of lines, some less avoidable than others. If I don't want to stand in a long line at a restaurant, I can go eat somewhere else. But if I've already bought an airline ticket and need to get through security, I can't just give up. Each line comes with its own set of circumstances and stakes. I am certainly not the kind of person who would stand in line for 45 minutes in the hot sun for a slice of pizza.
For a slice of pizza.
Two slices of pizza. Dan, for the amount of time that my buddy and I have been waiting on this freaking line, man. I'm telling you.
Since I don't have the patience for that kind of line, we sent this guy.
Hey, I'm Dan Pashman, and I host this podcast called The Sporkful, where I talk about eating and people eating.
But not eating of people. Or have you? Have you done cannibalism?
Not yet.
Pashman is a man of relatively simple food pleasures.
And I'm not someone who is easily taken by trends, food trends. Like, I'm not the guy that feels the need to run out and get the cronut when everyone's going crazy for it. So I have very little patience for that. But I do, once in a while, a place will capture my imagination. And often it's a place with a history or a story behind it.
A place like DeFara. It's a famous old-school pizzeria in Brooklyn.
It's been open for over 50 years. It's been run for that entire time basically by one man, Dom DeMarco, who came over from Italy and opened this pizzeria. And up until old age slowed him down a little bit, he made every single pizza that came out of that place. He still, at age 79, right now today, makes 90% or so of the pizza that comes out of there. And anytime you see a ranking of the top pizzerias in New York, DeFara is always towards the top. Everyone talks about how slow it is, how hard it is to get the pizza there. And I just sort of didn't want to be hassled. you and I were talking about this issue of waiting and waiting, and I said, maybe this is the time for me to give it a shot.
So basically, the reason you hadn't gone to Defarah in the past was because there's a long line, and the reason you went to Defarah finally is because there is a long line.
That's true. Yes, exactly.
And so, Dan Pashman went to Defarah to get some pizza for himself and to talk to the other customers waiting online.
It was a weekday afternoon, 90-something degrees and humid in New York City. And I should say, the neighborhood of Brooklyn this is in a pretty residential area. No skyscrapers, no big office buildings, there's not a big lunch rush like you might find in the city center in a lot of cities. The place opens at noon. By 11:30, 11:45, there were maybe 10 or 12 people in line.
Yes.
And I'm hungry. And I have a feeling it's going to be a long time before I eat. And at noon, the window opens. They start taking orders. They weren't letting anyone in because it was so hot and their air conditioning wasn't working right. So everyone had to stand outside to wait.
Three slices for Ali?
It's not a pleasant day to be waiting outside.
No, it's not.
Starting to wonder if this was a good idea.
Yeah. Definitely.
The first thing that struck me was, you know, everyone talks about the wait at Defarah. I always assumed that there would be a crazy long line. But that's actually not what causes the long wait. You will wait in line maybe for a few minutes, 5 or 10 minutes. Then you place your order. The wait, the holdup, is with the actual making of the pizza. And it just moves at a snail's pace. Like, it is painstaking to just, I mean, like, the place had been open for 20 or 25 minutes, and I don't think 10 slices of pizza had come out of the window yet.
And that's because this one 79-year-old guy, Dom DeMarco, is the one guy primarily making the pizzas. That's why it's so slow?
Right. Every slice of pizza, a pie comes out of the oven. He removes one slice. He puts it on the plate. He takes the handful of basil. He chops the basil by hand onto each slice individually. He grates the grana padano cheese onto the slice individually. And on one hand, I'm so enamored with this sort of painstaking work, you know, and the craftsmanship of it. On the other hand, I'm like, come on, get a guy to chop all the basil first thing in the morning and just move this thing along a little bit, you know. So that was the struggle for me when I was waiting.
Cash?
It's cash only, okay. Sorry.
It's getting close to 1 o'clock. I have not eaten a single bite of food yet. I would normally be like on the ground unconscious right now.
Talk to me about the other people in line and their view of the wait.
Well, that was one of the things that I wanted to find out. This is already a $5 slice of pizza, which even in New York City is a lot. I'm pretty sure it's the most expensive slice in the city. And on top of that, there's a million slice places in New York, maybe not quite as good as Defarah, but you could walk into almost any of them and get a good slice of pizza for $2. So I wanted to know how much more people would pay to not have to wait. And I started cornering people after they had been waiting for like 20 minutes already in the heat when they were at their most desperate and maybe they were already feeling a bit of a sunk cost situation. And every person I talked to said they would pay more than $5 if they could have had the pizza immediately.
$7, yeah.
Okay, definitely. What would you say if I told you could pay $10 for a slice of Defarah's pizza, but there'd be no wait at all?
I might potentially be tricked into doing it once just to have the experience, but there'd be no repeat business, that's for sure.
I see. What about $12 a slice?
I think once you get double digits, it's the cutoff.
If I told you could pay $12 for a slice and you'd get it right now, would you do it?
This establishment? Yes. In a heartbeat.
Yes.
Yes.
$15 a
yes,
slice.
Sir.
$15.
No. I would do it.
No.
Alden says no?
Ten for the most.
Mom?
No, I would do it.
$20.
I would do it. I would do it for 20.
25?
No, I don't know about 25. 20. I mean, we've already invested quite a bit just to get here, so that would be a nice convenience. They ought to open up a chain.
I'd be up to 25.
So do you really think that someone who claimed that they would spend $25 for one slice of pizza to not wait for it actually would? Or was that just their radio talking?
Yeah, I think that was a lot of big talk. I think you're right. But I do think that the people who said $7 or $8, I think that was legit. Especially, you know, you're asking them at that moment, they've already waited 20 minutes. They got another 20 or 30 minutes ahead of them. It's 90-something degrees out. And they've already paid for their pizza. So if you said to them, like, give me $3 more right now and I'll give you your pizza immediately, I think those people are telling the truth that they would.
How long you are willing to wait in a given line depends on a lot of things. How badly you want the thing at the end of the line, whether the thing you're waiting for is rare, perhaps even unique, and what you'd be doing with your time otherwise. But even if you are willing to wait, you'll have to admit, at least if you think like an economist, that a line represents a certain kind of failure, a failure of supply to seamlessly meet demand.
There's somewhere a scarcity. Whenever you see a line, the first thing to ask is, what's the scarcity?
That's Felix Oberholzer-Gee. He's an economist at Harvard Business School.
As a consumer in a market economy, you should expect that everything happens for you instantaneously all the time. And then when that's not true, you need to ask, what's the constraint? And the constraint is sometimes cost, is sometimes availability of skilled personnel, sometimes availability of space. But there's got to be some constraint, otherwise we wouldn't see a line.
To an economist, the way to handle this constraint is to raise prices.
But every now and then, for both for practical but also for moral reasons, we decide that, no, the price system, just jacking up prices until supply equals demand, is actually not the right thing to do.
And that's why he got interested in doing some research about line standing.
So the line research was a typical example where, as an economist, you look at lines and you have a sense of how it should be done. And then almost always you see that, sort of right, but not quite.
One problem with lines is that they're inefficient, in part because the order that you stand in line doesn't necessarily reflect how badly you want what's at the end of the line, or how much you'd be willing to pay for it. This led Oberholzer-Gee to wonder why more people don't pay to cut in line.
Is it that you could go to the person in front and you could offer money, but no one would ever let you in? Is it because there are moral qualms to do this, because there's something that's perceived to be particularly fair about lines and it's not something you do? Is it that people would not let you in because obviously if you let someone cut in, you create a negative externality on everyone else in the line because now they have to wait longer?
To find answers to these questions, Oberholzer-Gee designed an experiment. 10 researchers, including himself, approached hundreds of people on lines in 4 locations in Philadelphia. He was teaching at the University of Pennsylvania at the time. They went to a cafeteria at Penn. They went to the Amtrak station, a food court, and the Department of Motor Vehicles.
So the experiment is really simple. We pick a line, so for instance, in a cafeteria, and the experimenter would walk up to a person who's in front of the line, say position number 2 or the 3rd or 4th person in the line, and the experimenter would ask, can I cut in? If the person asks why, which sometimes happens, the experimenter would say, I would like to pay faster. So there's no long story about, I don't know, my mother and I have to get to her. And so there's as little information as possible.
That was one iteration of the experiment. In another, the researcher offered to pay.
The amount varied between $0 and $10. And then we just see what happens.
So what happens?
One of the interesting things is that actually people are quite nice. In about half of the cases, even if you don't offer money at all, people are willing to let someone cut in. And I think it's a sense that probably you wouldn't do this all the time. Probably it must be that you're in a particular rush, that you need to be somewhere. So all in all, even though there's the strong norm to not cut in line, if you ask nicely, most people are willing to do it.
Okay, a couple of things to say about that. When Oberholzer-Gee says there's a strong norm to not cut in line, that is true in the U.S. and in other places, including Canada and the U.K. The Brits, in fact, think of themselves as the originators of the queuing concept. Proper queue behavior is considered such an essential part of Britishness that a few years back, questions about queue behavior were nearly added to the UK's citizenship application. In any case, line standing is not a universal behavior. India, for instance, has been described as more familiar with the scrum than the line. The same goes for China and many other countries. Of course, you have to remember that lines represent more than culture. They represent supply and demand. And if you live in a place with too much demand or too little supply, the value of maintaining a proper queue would seem to be secondary at best. But If you know your wait will be rewarded, and if you are accustomed to waiting in a line, it wouldn't seem to be that big a deal to allow someone to cut in at least once in a while. And that's what Felix Oberholzer G. found in his experiment, even when he offered no money.
About 45% of the people will let you cut in.
And what about with the cash offer?
You see that the likelihood of being able to cut in increases from about 45% or so to 75% with $5 or $10.
Okay, that makes sense. But
the most surprising thing, which really is both interesting practically but theoretically speaking, is that while people are much more likely to let you cut in if you offer money, few people actually accept the monetary compensation.
Did you catch that? Most people don't accept the money.
So the typical conversation would go, can I cut in? Here's $5. You say, yes, of course, I'll let you cut in, but I'm not going to take your money.
To an economist, this does not seem like rational behavior.
Because we typically think that the price system, that the market works well for two reasons. One is prices indicate scarcity. If I offer $10, it must mean, well, boy, I'm really in a rush. If I offer just a dollar, yeah, I don't know, I might want to be a little faster, but it's probably not that valuable to me. And so that part of the price system actually worked beautifully. But what's also true about the price system is that the person who gives up something that is really valuable to someone else is supposed to be compensated. That's the whole theory of trades make both parties better off. I get something that is very valuable to me, and in exchange, I pay $5, $10. But that exchange doesn't happen.
So why didn't that exchange happen? When line cutters offered money, why did the line cuttees refuse to take it?
I think that's the sense in which lines are systems that we often use when auctioning off goods or services to those who have the highest willingness to pay seems inappropriate for moral reasons.
Inappropriate, at least, if you cut in line once. But what if you do it repeatedly? Oberholzer G. decided to go back the next day and ask the same people if he could cut in line again for the same amount of money. People were not so friendly this time.
It's sort of the way they tell you that, not again, don't think you can come here every day, these kinds of comments.
Which suggests, perhaps, that one of the social norms around line standing is that it's not cool to refuse someone who wants to cut in line until it becomes a regular thing. Because then the transaction moves from the moral realm to the financial realm. You are stealing time from me. A couple summers ago, I took a trip to France with my son for the European Championship soccer tournament. 24 European teams playing for the title. Since the fans of these teams identify themselves so plainly with jerseys and hats, it's a great chance to watch different nationalities' queuing behavior and drinking behavior and fighting behavior and so on, but those are topics for another day. The first game my son and I went to was Germany against Poland at the Stade de France in Paris. Given the recent terrorist attacks, there was a ton of security to get in, 3 or 4 different checkpoints before you even got to your gate to enter the stadium. And then, at our gate, there was a massive line, 100 yards long, maybe 200. So we went to the back. We are good, obedient Americans after all. And after 15 minutes, we hadn't moved at all. How could that be? People were getting into the stadium from our line. You could see that. But the line wasn't getting any shorter. Why? Because it was getting wider. Polish fans were walking up to the line in groups of 2 or 3 or 4 and just attaching themselves to the side of the line, like happy little barnacles, toward the front of the line, of course, not the back. They didn't look at the strangers they were joining in line. They would just look straight ahead, calmly, as if they'd been standing there for an hour, had to admire their sense of cool. The German fans, meanwhile, went to the back of the line, like us. Suckers, because the line kept getting wider and wider and wider as more and more Poles kept stealing more and more time from the Germans and us. Now, we had gone to this match as neutrals. We were just there to see the footy. We did not have a rooting interest between these two teams. But by the time we finally got inside, just before kickoff, believe me, we were firmly with the German supporters. As it turns out, it didn't matter. Was a 0-0 draw, but when Poland was finally eliminated from the tournament by Portugal, the eventual champion, we celebrated hard, even though Portugal was literally the last team we wanted to win the Euros. That is what a bad line-standing experience can do to a person. Because as inefficient as a line may be, it at least nods toward a sense of fairness. Everyone waits. Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, what do your taste buds think of waiting in line?
When other people were joining the line, then people reported that the smoothie tastes better.
And what's wrong with eliminating lines by just putting a price on everything?
That's not a decision that we feel comfortable with.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Standing in a line isn't so bad if the line isn't too long, if it moves along, if there's not a lot of uncertainty, and if it seems relatively fair to everyone who's waiting. How often are all those criteria met in the real world? Not often enough. The science of queue management has certainly gotten better. You know that if you've ever been to a Whole Foods store in New York City, where the lines are divided by color, by how much you're buying, and then the open registers are called out like bingo numbers. The gamification of line waiting, as mild as it may be, makes line waiting more bearable. But the real beauty of a Whole Foods line, at least, is that the wait simply isn't very long, in part because they spend a lot of money on cashiers. But what if there was another, totally different, maybe cheaper way to organize lines so that when you really want something, you wouldn't have to wait at all? You remember Steve Landsberg?
I teach economics at the University of Rochester. I write books about economics.
In his book, More Sex is Safer Sex, Landsberg describes a line-standing solution first proposed by an Israeli economist named Raphael Hassan.
Professor Hassan's wonderful idea is that instead of sending people to the back of the line, we send people to the front of the line. Each newcomer comes to the front of the line and pushes everyone else backward.
Rather than the standard first-come, first-served model, this system is called last-come, first-served. Yes, I know, doesn't seem to make any sense at first, but bear with me. Imagine there is a water fountain and you want a drink.
Each newcomer comes to the front of the line and pushes everyone else backward.
Okay, that's good for you, the newcomer, but what about everyone waiting online?
What that means is that if you're more than three or four places back, you have no hope of ever getting a drink because newcomers are going to arrive at some rate. There's going to be some point in the line where it's hopeless to wait for your drink, and therefore those people will give up, and that's a good thing.
That's a good thing. How?
It means the line will never be more than a few people long. The fountain still gets used because the stream of newcomers assures that, and the few people who are willing to wait in line assure that the fountain will be used even at the moments when no newcomer has just arrived. But not many people will be willing to wait in a line like that. And we want people giving up because we don't want them wasting their time in lines.
Okay. Doesn't that just seem unfair somehow?
Well, you say it's not fair, but the number of people who get served is the same number that would have gotten served under any other system.
But it's a different set of people who get served.
And, you know, you might think, well, this way some people never get served at all. That's true. But under the current system, some people never get served at all, namely the ones who are not willing to wait an hour. The same number of people are being denied service either way. The question is, how long are people waiting in line along the way? If we can minimize that, that would be great.
Landsberg admits that as appealing as this idea may be in theory, there are a lot of problems in practice.
And the biggest one is that if we were to implement this system, you would have to have a way of preventing people from leaving the line and then re-entering at the front. It's got to be only the genuine newcomer who gets the drink, not the person who was waiting in line and got out and ran up to the front. Enforcing that, I think, would be a nightmare.
And it would be a worse nightmare if the stakes were higher than just a drink of water. There's another problem. With last come, first served, you could wait forever, which is bad news if you're really, really thirsty. Under first come, first served, everyone eventually gets to the front of the line.
Making people wait does select for people who need the help more desperately. And that is a good thing about making people wait. But you still wouldn't want to make them wait in line because there's a better way to deal with it. And the better way to deal with it is to let them pay a little extra to go into a premium queue.
Landsberg acknowledges that a lot of people hate the idea of getting to pay your way out of waiting.
There are a lot of good ideas that people hate when you tell them about it. So I think partly people just don't realize how well markets work in many cases. And as a result of that, they're hostile to things that they end up not being hostile to once they've seen them.
Things like secondary markets.
That's right.
Felix Oberholzer G. again.
The role of the secondary markets is to go from the inefficient allocation to something that looks a little more efficient than what we had in the first place.
Like ticket resellers, like professional line standers who will do the waiting for you. But what feels socially acceptable changes over time and varies by place. And different people have different views of what's fair.
And I think that the deeper question here is, what's the line that describes when we feel uncomfortable using the price system? So take organs, right? We have a line for scarce organs. And at least in the United States, we don't feel comfortable saying, well, why do we have this line? Shouldn't we just auction off a liver becomes available? That's not a decision that we feel comfortable with.
People prefer a system in which there is a queue.
That's Ayelet Fishback.
Everybody is being served based on the amount of time that they invested, then a system of auction, a system where people are getting products or services based on how much money they have.
Fishback is a professor of behavioral science and marketing at the Booth School of Business at the University of Chicago.
I study many aspects of motivation. Among them is how to get people to be more patient, how to get them to value what they're waiting for, questions about self-control, about goal pursuit, and so on.
So Fishback designed some waiting experiments. In one, she wanted to know how people's value of something they get in line is affected by how many other people are waiting behind them. So she and her colleagues set up an on-campus smoothie sample tasting study. For half the participants, two researchers stood in line behind the participant to make it seem like others were waiting. For the other half, no one stood behind the smoothie taster.
When other people were joining the line, then people reported that the smoothie tastes better.
Which, to Fishback, showed that a line can signal value.
In other words, once we wait for something, we value it more than if it was effortless, than if we never had to wait.
She realizes this notion runs contrary to the economist's notion that lines are inefficient and undesirable.
Well, yes, people don't mind standing in lines.
Unless, of course, you're waiting not for an optional item like a smoothie, but for necessities like medicine or food or water, the way thousands of Venezuelans are currently doing.
We have to separate products for which the need is increasing from products where the need is quite stable. So if we are talking about someone that needs to get medical care, where long line is not good because they might get more sick. However, waiting for 6 months or so for a new iPhone might actually be a good idea for Apple, because really the need for an iPhone does not increase over time.
And for those things we don't urgently need, it may be that lines aren't just acceptable, they may be desirable. Moreover, Fishback argues, waiting can have a positive effect on our lives.
Yes, you're absolutely correct. So there is a ton of evidence connecting low patience with negative outcomes, okay, which could be career, academic, health, financial, and so on. But there is relatively less on how to do that, how to make people more patient. And getting people to pause and wait and not act on their immediate desire is actually one way in which we can get them to be more patient in the long run. And lines might happen to do that, even though they are rarely intended to help people develop character. or actually they are never intended to help people develop their ability to wait longer.
A high level of patience is linked to so many successful outcomes that Fishback has a hard time thinking of all of them.
Let me think of where I begin. Kids that are more patient, have more friends, get better grades, get better SAT scores, have, when they grow up, people that are more patient are able to study, to advance their career, they are able to maintain their marriage. There are several studies that show that many problems in life, addiction and not being able to keep a job, are associated with low self-control. Certainly, drinking, smoking are associated with low self-control. Basically, the person needs some immediate gratification and is unwilling to wait for the larger later reward, which is to be healthy in the long run. So I'm not saying that standing in lines is going to be the only way or the main way to improve people's patience. But certainly being patient is a key to being successful. There is a lot of research on that. The research on self-control and how that basically more important than having a high IQ for being successful in life.
And that is bad news for someone like me, since I am so impatient, since I get so irritated by Polish soccer fans cutting in line, and since I would never, ever wait in a long line in the hot summer sun just to get a slice of Brooklyn pizza, like Dan Pashman would.
Anytime you see a ranking of the top pizzerias in New York, DeFar is always towards the top. I always felt like that was something that I wanted to experience.
So you got there a half hour before it opened. The window opens at noon. You place your order, you said, within 10 or 15 minutes. And then you finally ate at about, what, 12:45 or so?
Yeah, I would say it was a 45-minute wait for our pizza.
I'll tell you what I would have done. Here's how you and I are different.
Okay.
I never would have gone to a place with a line.
Okay.
I respect that you do. I respect it.
Right.
Don't get me wrong. I just couldn't have done it. So I respect your patience, but tell me this, was it worth it?
I got to say, the regular slice is very good, but it's actually the square slice, the Sicilian slice, that is completely rocking my world. And you just listen to what it sounds like when you bite into this pizza. That crunch of the crust, holy cow. I'm glad I did it. The pizza was really delicious. I would go again, but I wouldn't go 25 more times, and I would only go with the right expectations.
Coming up next on Freakonomics Radio, the economics of bounty hunters.
I was shocked when I first saw this data. 25% of felony defendants simply failed to show up on the day of their trial.
The police have a 50-50 love-hate relationship with us. We get paid more for one arrest than they might make all week.
That's coming up right after this.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
So if I'm a criminal and I jump bail and I have to choose between having the cops bring me in for a trial or a bounty hunter, I definitely want to put that job in the hands of the police.
Bounty hunters are much more likely to get their man. I like to say that the bounty hunters are the true long arm of the law.
I know what you're thinking. Bounty hunters? Those motorcycle vigilantes with their glam rock hair and their big biceps and tattoos, those are the guys who have a higher capture rate than the police? Not exactly, says Alex Tabarrok. He's an economist at George Mason University and co-author of a paper that looks at the commercial bail bond industry.
So after we'd published this article, some of the bounty hunters actually got in touch with me. And I said, hey, you know, maybe I should be a little bit of a roguish kind of character. And I asked if I could go out with them actually on the streets and actually learn outside of my office what bounty hunting was all about.
Tabarrok went off with a bounty hunter named Dennis in Baltimore. He learned that bounty hunting is all about business. No high-speed chases, no gun battles. As Dennis made clear, you don't want to rough up the fugitives or their families because, well, here, Tabarrok will tell you.
The bounty hunters, they're very polite. Yeah, these guys, they're not breaking down doors at all. And I asked Dennis why this is. And he says it's because we do rely a lot on repeat business. You know, he tells me about one of his customers who told him quite proudly that we've been coming to this firm for three generations. You know, just awful, really.
Here's how commercial bail bonds work. Let's say you're arrested for a crime and the judge releases you on a $5,000 bail. Now, you don't have the money, so you go to your local bail bondsman. You fill out an application that asks for all kinds of information. Your previous arrests, your employer, union membership, make and model of your car, even your kids' names and where they go to school. Now, the bondsman agrees to pay the court that $5,000 in return for a 10% fee. So you pay him $500 and you sign a contract promising to show up in court. Now, if you're a no-show on your court date, it's the bondsman's $5,000 that's at risk. The judge gives him 90 days to find you, and that's when your bondsman picks up the phone, calls a bounty hunter. Alex, let's put the necessary cards on the table. Would you or would you not identify yourself as a libertarian?
Yeah, I guess I'm a free market type of person. So libertarian is a political term. I'd say more independent, but my leanings definitely go towards free markets, but also socially liberal side. So I guess that fits.
All right. So that being said, we have this big government-run law and order machine, you know, the police and the courts, and they are deputized by all of us indirectly through taxes to do their job. And we can't do that job. It's not citizen participation. I can't decide that something is legal or not. I can't really arrest somebody on the street. I certainly can't proclaim their innocence or guilt except as a member of a jury. And yet, there's this one little piece of it that we privatize, which is if somebody who needs to come before a judge won't, then some guy, could be me, could be you, it could be Dog the Bounty Hunter, is authorized to go bring him in. How weird is that?
It is a little weird, but you have to remember the weirdness may be the public system in one sense, in that it used to be all be private, or used to be much more private than it is today. And the way this used to run in Britain, even, you know, Britain didn't have, for example, public police until about the 1850s. And the way it used to run is you would actually hire an insurance company. And if you were robbed, the insurance company would not only pay you insurance money to, you know, recoup your losses, but they would also have money to hire inspectors, detectives, to go off and find out who had done this and to arrest them. So that private system, even today, we still have a little bit of that private system left over. So for, you know, when you insure the Hope Diamond or something like that, the insurance companies have quite still today a number of private detectives and private investigators who will go after people, not just in the United States, but on a worldwide scale. So there's a little bit of that private system still remaining. And I think the bounty hunter system is also part of this more private system we had in the past. And this is one bit which is still hanging on.
Under current law, bounty hunters have a lot of latitude. They can break into a fugitive's home without a warrant. They can chase suspects across state lines without worrying about extradition proceedings. They can search and seize without constraint. Now, there are some limits. Bounty hunters can't use unnecessary force, and they're liable if they break into the wrong home. But for some people, that's not nearly enough. Four states, Wisconsin, Oregon, Illinois, and Kentucky, have banned commercial bail bonds. And the U.S. is, in fact, one of only two countries in the world that allow this system. The other is the Philippines. One former Supreme Court justice called the bail bond industry odorous. But Alex Tabarrok, the economist, he doesn't see it that way. Especially if you look at the economics of the criminal justice system.
Yeah, I was shocked when I first saw this data. 25% of defendants, felony defendants, simply fail to show up on the day of their trial. This is a huge number. I was flabbergasted. So this means that the judge's time is wasted, the lawyer's time is wasted, the prosecutor's time is wasted, the police, they have to go out and try and recapture this guy. It's a big cost to the criminal justice system. And moreover, justice delayed is justice denied. If people can repeatedly flaunt the justice system by failing to show up and extend the time, which means that witnesses become harder to find. The more time it takes to get to the trial, people get evidence gets lost, paperwork gets lost, things get shuffled around, witnesses disappear, you know, they move, whatever. This really is a cost to the legal system.
Tabarrok and a colleague, Eric Helland, analyzed data on 36,000 felony defendants in the U.S.
And we thought it would be interesting to see whether people who are released on commercial bail, whether they're more likely to show up, and if they flee, are they more likely to be recaptured? Because if you're out on commercial bail and you flee, it's the bail bondsman who's out the money. The bail bondsman has put up your $5,000 bail, and if you don't show up, he loses the $5,000. So this is a classic case of incentives. Do incentives work? Do the bail bondsmen have the right incentives to go after these guys with the bounty hunters? That's where the bounty hunters come in and bring them back to justice.
Tabarrok found that people who are released on commercial bail, who know that a bounty hunter will be after them if they skip court, that they're substantially more likely to show up than someone who's released on his own recognizance or on government bail. In that case, you typically pay a deposit of just a few $100s. But fugitives behave differently when they know a bounty hunter may be after them. And it's not only the bounty hunter they're worried about.
The way a lot of this works is they get somebody to co-sign on the bond, a family member or a friend to co-sign on the bond. So this means that if the defendant skips town, that not only is the bail bondsman out, but potentially so is the friend who is co-signed on the bond or the family member who is co-signed on the bond. And I asked again Dennis about this. And he says, I deal with a lot of mean people in my business. These guys, they're not afraid of me. They're not afraid of the police. But they're still afraid of their mother. So if I get the mother to co-sign on the bond, and this guy knows that the mother might lose her house if he doesn't show up for trial, he's going to show up for trial.
So the fugitives have an incentive to not run away. But if they do, the bounty hunters really have an incentive. Unlike a police officer who's on salary, a bounty hunter only gets paid if he brings a fugitive in. And the data prove it. Tabarrok found that bounty hunters are 50% more likely than the police to get their man. Wow, so if I'm a taxpayer, which I happen to be, then I have to be thinking, wow, so we've got a system of law and order. We try to find the bad guys. We give them their day in court. But while they're waiting for that day in court, they're often out on bail, free to roam around. And then if I, as a taxpayer, want to make sure that my dollars are well spent and that the bad guys are being brought back in for trial, I like the private industry take on this more than the government take on this a lot, don't
yeah,
I?
Yeah, you really do, because not only do the bail bondsmen work at no taxpayer expense, there's a little bit of a justice involved in that the guys who flee, they're paying their own pursuers. I kind of like that. It's from the these defendants themselves. Uh-huh. The money comes for the bounty hunters to go after them. And it's even a little bit better than that, because the bounty hunters, they're good, but they don't always get their man. You know, sometimes the guy flees town, and the bounty hunters, the bail bondsmen, they usually have about 90 to 180 days. So the judge says, if this guy, the bounty hunter has put up $5,000 of bail, and the judge says, this guy hasn't showed up, he tells the bail bondsman, you've got 90 to 180 days, it varies by state, to bring this guy to justice. If you don't bring him to justice within that period of time, that bail is forfeit. So when that bail is forfeit, that actually goes to the taxpayer. So the taxpayer can actually make some money. And this is not a huge chunk of change, but it's millions of dollars in different states and at the federal level, forfeit bonds actually go to a crime victim fund. So that's kind of a nice, also a nice piece of justice to this, I think.
I don't know what you're up to, but I'm working.
Oh, working? Me too.
I heard you got kicked off the force.
What I do is I hunt down idiots who jump bail.
You are a bounty hunter?
Yep. As much as it pains me to say this, I gotta take you to jail.
Well, all right, my name is Bob Burton. I'm in California. I run a large organization composed of bounty hunters. We operate throughout the United States, coast to coast, border to border. We made over 30,000 arrests last year of individuals who failed to live up to the bail bond contract.
Bob Burton used to run the National Association of Bail Enforcement Agents, which in 2014 merged with the National Association of Fugitive Recovery Agents. Before that, he was a Marine and then a karate teacher. Burton has passed away since we interviewed him. We began with how he got his start as a bounty hunter.
Well, my career as a bounty hunter began when I was an insurance broker in California in the early 80s. A friend of mine, Bob Brown, started a magazine called Soldier of Fortune Magazine.
Oh, yeah.
Out of Boulder, Colorado. We were buddies, and he asked me to go down to El Salvador to cover the war, which was starting down there. I was saturated with a need for adrenaline, like I had never felt before. The adrenaline of the war, dealing with Green Berets, enemy, incoming fire, beautiful women in the city, rogue scoundrel, newsmen from all over the world. I couldn't be an insurance broker anymore, so I went into bounty hunting. And my luck was that I knew some bounty hunters. They took me into the business and taught me, and I wanted a book. I could not find any book, so it turned out I wrote the book Bounty Hunter, which turned out to be the first book ever written on the subject, unbeknownst to me. And then one step further, by 85, Robert De Niro's manager saw the book, bought it, and then made the movie Midnight Run based on the book.
Let's go. Wait a minute, wait, it's a freight train. I can't do this. I can't do this.
Now, Bob, there are some academics who've studied the data on inmates who jump bail to see whether bounty hunters are more efficient, more effective at bringing them in than police, have found that the answer is yes. I'm guessing this finding doesn't really surprise you too much, does it?
It doesn't, because frankly, we know we capture about 94 to 96% of everybody that jumps bail.
Actually, a Department of Justice report says that bounty hunters capture 97% of the fugitives they pursue. 97%.
The NYPD, the LAPD, and the Chicago PD fugitive details arrest about 50 to 60% of all wanted individuals. Why? They only work a 40-hour week. They get paid regardless.
Now, it's not that the police are slacking off. It's just, as Burton points out, that the police and bounty hunters have different incentives and different duties. The police have other cases to pursue, other jobs to do. Sometimes the police and a bounty hunter will be going after the same fugitive, which can lead to friction.
Yeah, the police have a 50-50 love-hate relationship with us because we are doing what they do. We get paid more for one arrest than they might make all week. We're rivals with the detective division of that man's area. And for instance, every time we pop someone in New York City, the NYPD's detective division, on one hand, okay, one less case, but on the other hand, why the hell did those bounty hunters get to them before we did?
A bounty hunter's salary can vary greatly, depending on a lot of factors, especially, of course, the size of the bond. Burton says a typical bounty hunter earns between $48,000 and $65,000 a year, which is pretty much in line with a police officer's salary. Bounty hunters do have to pay for their own equipment, though.
Well, when you come into the business, first thing you got to do is buy a good $35, $40 pair of handcuffs. Then you got to buy a pistol if you don't already have one, $350 to $500. You should have a four-door car, ideally a van, where you can transport the prisoner from New York to New Orleans. because prisoners flee. When they flee, the bondsman's going to call a bounty hunter in the area, the targeted area that he's fleeing to. Like New York agents get calls all the time from Miami, New Orleans, Texas, you name it. Agents flee to New York or they go back home to New York.
Dog the Bounty Hunter is on TV. I'm guessing that if people watch that show and they come away with an impression of how a bounty hunter acts in his daily business, I'm guessing that's maybe a tiny bit exaggerated. The Bounty Hunter. Can you help me out there?
It's grossly exaggerated. First of all, no one in the industry acts or rather looks like that. We're dealing with cops, judges, district attorneys. We can't look the way he looks. Forget the long hair, you stand out, and it's pure television nonsense the way he looks.
And in addition to the look, though, talk to me about what the work of a bounty hunter is actually like on a daily basis. What do you have to do, and what do you have to do well to be a good bounty hunter?
A bounty hunter work is 97% boredom, 3% adrenaline. It's sitting in cars, working on the telephone, calling people, trying to find an answer where he would be. You have to be good on the phone as a bounty hunter. You must have phone skills. You must have an ability to talk to street swine and district attorneys and attorneys. The bottom line is we look for the fugitive and the Judas. Everybody has a Judas in their life. An ex-girlfriend might betray him because he ran off with someone else. A rival crack dealer will betray him because he wants that guy out of the system and because he's competition. There's always someone that will betray you.
Now, Bob, just between you and me, if I was a bounty hunter looking for you, who's your Judas?
Good question. There's probably 15 surfer chicks here at the beach in Santa Barbara.
Just 15? A guy like you? I'm surprised well, it's only 15.
See, in my business, AARP means an American ready to party. Okay?
And tell me about the one that got away. Tell me about one guy you couldn't find and how he avoided you.
Hundreds of guys. Most bounty hunters are lucky to capture 90% of their fugitives. But you always lose 10%. There was a woman I jumped bail on me a couple of years ago. She was a Samoan woman with tattoos on her face.
And, doesn't sound that hard to find.
I know, but unless you're in the Samoan community and they won't talk to you. And frankly, I couldn't tell when I looked at the picture, I thought she was a man. Anyway, she disappeared on me 3.5 years ago. And it was a simple thing, a DUI. And I have used Samoans in my work. And someone gave me the case thinking I had good contacts, which I did. But no one knew where she was. And then a year or so ago, or not even that, 5-8 months ago, I find her on Facebook. And there she is. Facebook has turned out to be a good weapon for us to use against bad people. Because no matter how bad they are, they jump bail, they still have an ego thing or they need friends, and they go on things like Facebook. They put their picture up there. And when you're a Samoan with a tattoo on your face, you're not going to be able to hide very easily.
Did she use her real name on Facebook?
No, she didn't use her real name on Facebook, but she had something similar, and I typed in one of my computer gurus, a 16-year-old, did it for me, and he found her on Facebook.
And so what then? You friended her, and that began the...
No, it was over. See, we only have 6 months to find the bad people out here in California. Like most states, 6 months, a couple of years at max. So after 6 months, the bondsman had to go down and pay his, he bailed her out on a DUI.
So why were you still looking for her? Why was she even still on your radar to find her on Facebook if there was no money left in it?
Well, I didn't find her on Facebook. Someone said they saw a chick on Facebook with a tattoo on her face. And that reminded me of this 2-year-old case. And I said, well, see if you can pull up. I'd like to see what she looks like. And there it was, same tattoo, left eyebrow, left over the left eyebrow. And, you know, it's rare enough to, you know, it's not a coincidence. So it was her. But I had no interest in finding her. And you know, Facebook, you know, you don't always know where they are.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. As always, thanks for listening. We'll be back next week, same time, same station. If you can't wait that long, remember, you can find our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at Freakonomics.com or at Apple Podcasts, where you can also subscribe. Thanks so much.